everybody. Welcome to OK Talks. I'm your host, Oliver Kendall. I'm a lifelong political nerd with an academic background in international relations focused in security policy and real-world experience working in the U.S. domestic political space and living in a number of other countries than my own, all of which combined, I think, positions me fairly well both to interpret for my international audience what's going on in the politics of my own country, and to shed light for some of the folks back home on some events of note going on in the rest of the world. So, I originally thought this was going to be another OK Takes episode, where I'd bounce around to a couple of different topic areas, but in the end, there were just so many developments related to what I was discussing the last two episodes that I think I'll end up largely staying in that neighborhood. But before we get into things, I want to just encourage anybody who hasn't already to be sure to follow or subscribe to the podcast channel or whatever it's called on whichever platform you listen. And if you have ideas for the show, things you think I should be talking about, people you think I should have on, please do go ahead and reach out at oktalkspodcast@gmail.com. And most importantly, as always, be sure to share the show with anybody you think might get something out of it. So with all that out of the way, let's get into it. So, just right off the bat, I want to address one really stupid thing that I've seen from people reacting to the big missile and UAV strike on Israel from the weekend before last. Okay, one thing before I get to that, just a side note. From here on out, I'm just going to refer to the government of Iran as the IRI, the Islamic Republic of Iran. For reasons that I explained in the last episode, I really don't want to just call it Iran, since I don't think that the Iranian people deserve to be lumped in with the vicious priesthood that has ruled over them for the last half century or so. In any case, to the stupid thing that I was talking about, some of the responses to that IRI attack on Israel have taken the tone of...
Bomb, 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 Iran. Bomb, 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 bomb.
Like a, yeah, let's flatten Tehran kind of deal. And this is just incredibly stupid on like a number of levels. First of all, strategically, a massive attack on Iranian civilians would certainly invite a response in kind. Second of all, morally, a massive attack on Iranian civilians would be wrong. And thirdly, strategically again, well, the Iranian population is more sympathetic to Israel and the West more broadly than is the population of possibly any other Middle Eastern country with the exception of Israel. Like, one of the profound ironies of the modern Middle East is the fact that we have basically a number of Arab Sunni majority countries whose populations are riddled with Islamic extremism and anti-Semitism and sexism and other things that we don't like, ruled by often problematic but at least more moderate than their populations and pro-Western governments that keep a lid on things. And then on the other hand, we have Iran, a Shia majority country whose population is, as I say, more aligned with liberal values than any other Middle Eastern country with the obvious exception of Israel and the possible exception of Turkey, but ruled over by a truly vile government that is the primary state sponsor of terrorism all around the world. The Iranian people, they're not the enemy here. Hell, we've seen over just the last few years, we've seen them stage massive protests against their government, against the repression of women sparked by the murder, effectively, by the IRI's morality police of a girl named Mahsa Amini, whose crime was, you know, not wearing her hijab tightly enough. I had my dear friend Hafideh Gorgi on this show, I believe in episode 30 a year or two ago, talking about those protests, which she and I were both joining here in Spain. And you know who tends to know this? Israelis. They tend to know that, which is why you don't see a lot of stupid talk from Israelis about turning Tehran into a parking lot, because they know that the sort of Iranians who live in Tehran are about as representative of the movement that backs the IRI regime as people who live in Los Angeles, New York, and, I don't know, Portland are of the Trump movement. A response to the IRI attack on Israel by killing a whole bunch of people in the part of Iran who are the least supportive of the regime would be insanity. In any case, late this past week, Israel did go ahead and launch their response to that previous barrage of drones, crews, and ballistic missiles launched from the IRI. And no, they did not flatten Tehran. There had been speculation about how and if the Israeli government would retaliate in some way. I was sort of agnostic before as to whether or not I thought that they should. And in the end, they did go ahead and do something in a way that, frankly, to me at least, seems to have been pretty well done. They hit what seemed to have been like a couple of IRI military targets inside of Iran. As far as I know, there haven't actually been any casualties at all. The attack by the Israelis, to me, looked calculated to send a message without actually inflaming things further. That message being, hi, I see you tried to overwhelm our air defenses by launching a massive attack with what would have in theory hit our civilian population if we didn't stop it. Your large-scale attack did not manage to overwhelm our air defenses. Our comparatively small one did manage to overwhelm yours. Now, we're not going to do a ton of damage right now, but you probably shouldn't try that again, because clearly we can and will get through your air defenses if we want to. Having seen this play out, I am increasingly convinced that it was indeed the right call, and that doing nothing at all would have probably sent a message to the IRI that it can launch large-scale attacks against Israeli civilians without necessarily getting hit back, which, well, is not a lesson that the world should want them to learn. The first confirmation that this was in fact a good call, I think, actually came from the IRI's own response. So almost immediately after the attack, Western media outlets and observers of this sort of conflict on Twitter were reporting that Israel had managed to hit a fair number of targets, but the state-run media in Iran, on the other hand, was basically like, oh, nothing to see here. You know, we shot down a couple of enemy drones and stuff, you know, no big deal. Which clearly indicates a desire to be able to at least claim that it was nothing and thus save face without having to go to the trouble of responding. So even before seeing that official reaction from the IRI, it was interesting to watch the sort of public conversation play out around these strikes in real time. I stupidly stayed up all night on Twitter and watched the various takes come in. Now, one response that stuck with me, and that I'm now going to use to spin off into a little like side thing about foreign policy philosophy, came from Pod Save America host and former Obama foreign policy guy Tommy Vitor, who, at the first news that the Israelis had in fact responded to the previous IRI attack, posted a hair-on-fire tweet along the lines of, oh my god, how dare Israel escalate this? And I just want to say, I don't say any of what I'm about to say to attack Pod Save America. It's my favorite place to hear the words, I think that's right, John, 10 times in the space of 45 minutes. In all seriousness, it is a great show and does really solid analysis, at least of domestic politics from a left-of-center perspective. But I think this tweet from Vitor sort of typifies a kind of faulty foreign policy logic that I think was a bit too pervasive in the Obama administration's approach to the world, and a logic that showed itself in arguably that administration's single largest ongoing foreign policy mistake, that is to say, the failure to successfully deter Russia. Now, this, I believe, stemmed basically from a failure to grasp that there are genuinely bad actors in the world and that those bad actors will interpret failure to respond to their provocations as a sign of weakness, which then invites more and more provocations. So, yeah, you know what, yeah, I am gonna just go down this rabbit hole for a second here. So, back in 2012, when Vladimir Putin retook the presidency of Russia, it became pretty clear pretty quickly that he was not going to play nice, despite the Obama administration's few years of like relative getting along with his temporary predecessor, Putin's predecessor, Vladimir Medvedev, that is to say. So this evidence that he was not going to play nice started with a campaign by the Russian security services to harass U.S. diplomats in other places around the world, up to and including, as was reported at the time in the Washington Post, Russian operatives breaking into the house of and taking a shit on the rug of a U.S. diplomat. Apparently our response to this, like, coordinated harassment campaign was just to, like, have John Kerry, like, ask the Russians to stop, I don't know, maybe pay for the dry cleaning or something. So then it escalated from that to Russian military assets, like, buzzing NATO positions. We basically just took this, as far as I know. The Obama administration then failed to enforce its own red line around chemical weapons in Syria when it came to the Russians' puppet regime, Bashar al-Assad. They did not do what every serious foreign policy expert said they should do by putting a no-fly zone in place in Syria, which itself paved the way for more aggressive Russian involvement in that war. Then the Obama administration refused to send any sort of lethal aid to the Ukrainians when the Russians basically just bit off a piece of that country in 2014 in Crimea and other parts of eastern Ukraine. And then when the Russians launched a coordinated campaign to put a fully compromised asset in the Oval Office, as far as I'm aware anyway, our response was basically nothing. Like, we released a statement during, which got swamped by news of the Trump Access Hollywood tape about grabbing women. And then after that campaign, you know, had succeeded in Trump winning the election, you know, we put a few sanctions in place, expelled a couple of, you know, obviously known Russian intelligence officers. That's it. And I don't say any of this to say that I don't like President Obama or didn't think he did a good job overall as president. I do, and I think he did. But this, let's not respond to provocations because it might lead to escalation thinking, unfortunately, is often a trap. One that that administration, at least, fell into way too often. And we need to identify it, and when necessary, debunk it to avoid continuing to fall into it, because it often just does not work. In Putin's case specifically, well, his entire approach to foreign policy is clearly driven by the old Lenin adage, advance with your bayonets, if you encounter mush, continue, if you encounter steel, stop. And the same really does appear, at least, to apply to the Islamic Republic regime in Iran. Under the cover of its proxies, the IRI has managed to build up malign influence all across the Middle East and plainly interprets the appearance of weakness as an opportunity to push further. But, lo and behold, if you hit back, as the Israelis did this week, well, sometimes at least, the IRI will back down. That's not to say that the correct response to every single provocation is always to go in guns a-blazin', but on the other hand, nor is it to never respond. Bullies who face no consequences for taking your lunch money will continue to take your lunch money. Speaking of bullies, and unfortunately, yeah, I think that is an accurate transition considering some of the behavior that I'm about to talk about here, the anti-Israel protests that have been happening in the U.S. reached a real fever pitch of obnoxiousness this last week. And before I start talking about this, I want to just reiterate something that I've been driving at over the last couple of episodes. I think it's really important to not, as a number of media outlets have unfortunately still been doing, fall into the trap of referring to these protests across the board as pro-Palestine demonstrations. As you'll see from the various examples that I lay out over the next couple of minutes, a lot of the focus has, well, putting it mildly, drifted rather beyond the goal of peace and the achievement of a two-state solution, which, for the record, is the only way that a Palestinian state ever stands any chance of coming into existence, and failure to recognize that fact will only get more people killed. Considering the nature of a lot of these protests, I think it's both more accurate and more fair to those who are actually pushing for peace and serious solutions and who shouldn't be tarred by a lot of this bad behavior to call these protests we've been seeing anti-Israel protests rather than pro-Palestine ones. So that's largely how I'm going to refer to them here. I'm sure there are plenty of people among those out protesting right now who are just there to support a lasting peace and a two-state solution. I'm sure there are some of those. Frankly, I'm sure that I know some of those. And for the record, everything I say over the next couple of minutes is not directed at people like that. Although I will say, if you showed up for what you thought was a peace protest, but then the people around you start chanting calls to bomb Tel Aviv, why wouldn't you just leave? But, okay, a lot of people other than me have rightly pointed out lately that a lot of these increasingly violent, or at least, like, employing violent rhetoric protests that we've been seeing on college campuses have not, shall we say, been, like, primarily focused on building peace and finding a solution to the conflict. And if your protest is primarily focused on pushing for some outcome other than that, well, no, again, you're not pro-Palestine, you're just anti-Israel. And big chunks of the media, as far as I've seen, have, unfortunately, been doing a pretty bad job of making that distinction. It's showing only, you know, a sanitized set of images from these protests which leave out the nastier bits. Really, unfortunately, if you're not spending a decent bit of time on Twitter, which, for the record, is extremely understandable, actually, no, maybe I should say, rather, if you're getting the bulk of your news about these protests from the kinds of newspapers that I tend to favor, like the New York Times or the Washington Post, well, you've probably seen coverage mostly along the lines of, well, the administration said A, and the protesters said B, and then the police kicked out some of the protesters, just like in 1968 or something. And then pictures of signs calling for a ceasefire and a cute little row of suspiciously identical tents all set up on the quad. And that, I'm sorry, is just not close to representative of the whole story here. Now, I had written several days ago a number of things about this, about Columbia University's decision to suspend a few of these protesters and to ask the police to remove some who refused to leave when they were asked to do so. I looked at the irony of the, like, sudden, deep concern for the protection of free expression on college campuses from a lot of people and outlets that, well, hadn't seemed very concerned about that up until now. The same people and outlets that have spent the last decade or so poo-pooing the chorus of warnings from people all over the ideological spectrum, mind you, about a growing lack of free speech on college campuses, the fact that more and more any viewpoint right of far left has been being censored or driven off campus entirely by a heckler's veto, often in the name of quote-unquote safety, because students might be traumatized by hearing things they disagree with. But now that a number of these protests have come with, like, actual, genuine, physical threats to people's safety, well, I talked about the reality that free speech does not, nor should it, include an unlimited right to harass or disrupt. I had written a bunch of stuff about all that. But it was too long, and also referred to a bunch of specific details that, although interesting, I think, are now several days old and have been replaced by a whole bunch more of them. So, I think to prevent this from becoming yet another 45-minuter, I will stay a bit more general, try to update on some of these things, and, most importantly, to provide some context that, as I said before, unfortunately, does not seem to be making its way, at least that much, into either the coverage or at all into the super gaslighty public statements by a number of people and organizations that have decided that, for whatever reason, they're going to try to sweep the nastier elements of these protests under the rug. Like this one, which was shared pretty widely. Here, take a listen.
Hey, remember the 7th of October!
Never forget the 7th of October!
That will happen!
Never forget the 7th of October!
Not 1 more time! Not 5 more times! Not 10 more times! Not 100 more times! Not 1,000 more times! Not 10,000 times!
My understanding is that's either on Columbia's campus or just outside of it. And in case the audio isn't clear enough, that's a couple of little assholes in their $4 Amazon.com keffiyehs shouting, quote, "Remember the 7th of October. That's not going to happen just one time, or 10 times, or 100 times, or 1,000 times, but 10,000 more times. The 7th of October is about to be every fucking day for you. You ready?" Unquote. Yeah, Jewish students, especially at Columbia, have been telling us for months now that they often felt threatened and harassed. Maybe they had a point. So that was a few days ago, I believe the same day that Columbia administrators went out to talk to the protesters gumming up the quad, asked them to please pack up their tents and go back to the dorms, got ignored, so then asked the police to come and clear them out. There have been a whole bunch more incidents of very obvious anti-Semitism at Columbia and on a number of other campuses since then, to the point where the Biden administration has since released a statement criticizing what's going on. Which I don't think that this rather low-key, you know, doesn't need to weigh in on everything administration would be doing if all we were seeing was, like, peaceful protests in favor of a ceasefire. These are, again, I don't know if I want to say largely, but at least to enough of a degree that they are quite noticeable, not exactly people calling for an end to the violence and a two-state solution. Rather, they're chanting things like, "We don't want no two states, we want 1948, and there is only one solution, Intifada Revolution, and from the river to the sea, Palestine will be either free or Arab," depending on if they're chanting in English or Arabic. Now, to be clear, all of those are calls to violence, and they're just a sampling of the various things being shouted by large groups of people on these college campuses. I mean, really, it appears that the only criteria applied by these protesters to whether or not to chant something is the question of if it rhymes. And no, this is not just one or two bad apples. These are things being chanted by large groups of people on multiple different college campuses. Oh wait, here's one more. I believe also from Columbia, but probably other places as well. They reference the Hamas Al-Qassam Brigade. So, "Al-Qassam, make us proud, take another soldier out. We want justice, you say how? Burn Tel Aviv to the ground. Hamas, we love you, we support your rockets too." Yeah. Ceasefire now, am I right, guys? And, you know, as comical as some of these ridiculous chants are, it does go beyond just getting hundreds of people together on individual campuses to chant calls for violence. I've seen videos of an Arab-Israeli student at Columbia, I believe, just off campus, getting punched in the face by keffiyeh-wearing anti-Israel protesters because he had the temerity to film them in their protests. Students have been physically pushed out of places on campus because they were wearing a Star of David necklace, I should say that one, video of which was all over the internet over the weekend at Columbia, involved a crowd of cultural revolutionaries doing a weird sort of call and response while forming a human chain to shove this kid out of their, you know, little camp because he was wearing a Star of David necklace. Columbia's administrators decided, you know, in the last couple of days, to just have all their classes online, because the chances of anti-Israel protesters harassing people on campus and starting a riot are high. A well-known Jewish-Israeli professor was physically barred from the campus at Columbia for security reasons, and the chief rabbi at Columbia has urged Jewish students to simply leave the campus because of concerns that it's physically unsafe. And this is all just at Columbia. There's been plenty of reports and video footage of Jewish students being attacked and harassed elsewhere by anti-Israel protesters. One kid at Yale got whacked in the face with a flagpole January 6th style. It's all the rage right now. And the totality of these events probably should be enough for us to recognize that whether or not there are two or three Jewish students from the weird anti-Israel fringe group Jewish Voices for Peace in the crowd so that a few of the marchers can say, "Look, I have a Jewish friend." This all taken together represents mass anti-Semitism of a sort that we have not seen in a very long time, and managing to still not see it requires Olympic levels of mental gymnastics. Now, anybody who listens to OK Talks regularly enough to have heard me talk about this issue at all before now knows that I am horrified by the situation in Gaza and disagree with a number of the decisions that have been made by the Israelis in terms of how to prosecute that war against Hamas. I deplore Benjamin Netanyahu and his borderline fascistic coalition that runs the Israeli government right now, and I very much want to see the creation of a Palestinian state, and the sooner the better. And if you haven't heard me talk about all that and want to hear me do it some more, well, go listen to episode 63. But neither the situation in Gaza nor how much Benjamin Netanyahu sucks in any way justify attempts to delegitimize the very existence of the Jewish state or attacks on Jewish people more broadly. For those of us who are left of center, progressives, liberals, whatever word we want to use, it really shouldn't be that hard to deplore the humanitarian nightmare in Gaza without ourselves engaging in anti-Semitism or aligning with or running cover for people who, if we're honest with ourselves, pretty obviously are. I mean, we were all outraged at the anti-Semitism on display just a couple years ago, back in 2018, at the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally. You know, the tiki torch-wielding Nazi-palooza thingy. Not to mention Trump's "very fine people on both sides, okay?" response to it. But that righteous outrage, well, it's gonna look pretty fucking hypocritical in retrospect if we can't find it in ourselves to also condemn this shit. Speaking of condemning things, lest I give the impression that the only bad behavior that bothered me this past week was the most obnoxious anti-Israel protesters, both the ones on campus harassing Jewish students and the ones off campus, like, blocking bridges and stuff, which, for the record, is inevitably gonna get somebody killed when, like, an ambulance fails to reach its destination or something. Well, in any case, far-right Republican Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas took, like, exactly the wrong position on the protest this past week when he came out multiple times straight up calling for bystanders to not bother getting the police involved, but rather just take matters into their own hands. He made a bunch of obviously not actually kidding jokes about wet protesters, suggesting that people should effectively murder demonstrators on the Golden Gate Bridge by throwing them over the side, among a bunch of other things. This is gross. I really don't, by instinct, have a ton of sympathy for people blocking a bridge when it's literally the only way to get across, even if I don't find a lot of the people doing so to be at best moral hypocrites, but, like, no. No violence. No encouraging violence. Especially elected leaders. I mean, Tom Cotton, you know, he went to Harvard Law School, he served in the military. Does this man not feel any responsibility to set a better example? I mean, does he not remember what happens these days when political leaders encourage people to get violent, especially in his party? I mean, I'm pretty sure that he was in the Capitol on January 6th. Doesn't end well. And it would also, it has to be said, not end well for anyone dumb enough to actually take Senator Cotton up on his stupid advice. Because civilians in America don't actually get to assault people even if they're blocking traffic or in some other way being incredibly obnoxious. We have a lot of freedoms in the US. The freedom to toss people off bridges or rip their hands off something they glued themselves to is not among them. One final thought related to the whole broader theme of the way in which people might choose to protest. And I can't believe I have to say this, but we've got to stop incentivizing people to light themselves on fire. So in December this past year, someone set themselves on fire outside the Israeli consulate in Atlanta, and more recently, a U.S. airman named Aaron Bushnell lit himself on fire outside the Israeli embassy in D.C., he'd started posting stuff about genocide and settler colonialism and a whole bunch of the other often incorrectly used faux intellectual buzzwords popular among the hardcore anti-Israel crowd. But after his act of extreme protest, as he put it in advance, a lot of people, like, rather than encouraging those considering suicide to seek help, instead hold this person up as an example of, like, a hero whose actions to aspire to. But Aaron Bushnell wasn't a hero, he was a victim. If you note my use of the past tense, tragically, he was pretty obviously the victim of a tidal wave of misinformation that drove him to a place of such extreme anguish and frustration that he lit himself on fire and died what I can only assume was a horrible death. And celebrating this fact, the glorious martyrdom of it all, it's just gross. And by the way, we'll almost certainly encourage other people, especially ones who have an underlying mental illness, and I should say, I don't know if that was the case with Bushnell specifically, but I do know that keeping posthumous praise and glory and accolades on what this poor guy did will almost certainly encourage other people to also think about trying to intentionally die for a cause. And I bring this up this week, not just because I've been talking in this episode about the excesses and maximalism of a lot of the anti-Israel protesters, but also because just the other day, some other guy showed up near the courthouse in New York where Trump's trial is taking place, tossed a bunch of weird conspiracy theory pamphlets in the air, and then lit himself on fire, and is now also no longer alive. And I definitely saw a few Trumpy influencers on Twitter at least kind of celebrating this guy. Look, my point is this. Martyrdom, not actually a good thing. I don't mean to say that nobody who's ever died for a cause was a hero and we shouldn't celebrate. I mean, obviously, many people who have died for causes absolutely are heroes. But if we want to celebrate someone who died for a cause, well, we should start by celebrating them and maybe the cause, not specifically the fact that they died for it. Dying for a cause can be noble, but it should be seen as a last resort, not glorified as the most desirable outcome. I mean, sacrificing oneself when there was no other choice, that's one thing. Celebrating the act of, going out of the way to intentionally die for one's beliefs, making that something to aspire to, well, I think that's a different thing, and one that usually leads to a bad place. Leads to the place where suicide bombers and kamikaze pilots come from. And if we turn people who commit suicide for a cause into heroes, well, we're going to get a whole lot more dead people, and it's probably not going to be only people who chose to do it. A while ago, we basically collectively decided to try to avoid publicly naming the people who carry out mass shootings so as not to make them famous and thereby encourage others to follow in their footsteps. And this, I think, is exactly the same logic we should apply to people intentionally killing themselves in order to experience the glory of martyrdom for whatever cause they subscribe to. Now, I don't mean to imply specifically that the three acts of self-immolation that I just talked about a couple of minutes ago are up on the same moral plane as, a school shooting. I want to be clear, I don't mean to imply that. But, again, glorifying martyrdom usually doesn't lead to a great place. All we gotta do is take a look at other cultures, both past and present, where intentional martyrdom is something massively to be aspired to, in order to recognize it's probably not something that we in the liberal West should want to adopt. And fortunately, we have many, many examples of successful, peaceful protest movements both in the West and in other places in the world that we can look to for inspiration instead. That's it for this episode of OK Talks. If you like the show and want to make sure not to miss the next episode, in which I think I can promise I won't just talk about the situation in the Middle East or reactions to it, hit subscribe or follow the show on whatever platform you listen, or shoot me an email at oktalkspodcast@gmail.com to be added to the email list. If you really want to do me a favor, be sure to like the show and leave a review, and most importantly, share it with anybody you think might get something out of it. To those who already have, thanks. To those who will, thanks in advance. Thanks as always to Nate Wright for having designed the podcast artwork, and to everyone else for listening.